This is a lecture series from Tikva Ideas commemorating the Yom Kippur War on its 50th anniversary. Together, over the course of 6 lectures, we're going to explore what we know now about the war and what went on behind the scenes. When Tikva Ideas first asked me to teach this course on the Yom Kippur War, I jumped at the chance. I saw it as an opportunity to convey my perspective on the Arab-Israeli conflict and on U.S.-Israeli relations, a perspective that I had developed over the last 25 years, ever since I started working in this field. What I mean to say is, I saw it as an opportunity to convey old ideas to a new audience. I wasn't expecting to learn new things. However, as I started collecting books and articles and documents, I began to make discoveries. Those discoveries led me to ask new questions, the answers to which took me to some surprising places. Things that I thought were familiar became very unfamiliar, and new things that I learned began to look more and more important to me, more important than some of the things that I had previously considered to be extremely important. As a result, I can't escape the feeling that I'm in the middle of a journey and not at my destination. What I want to do now is to leave you with 3 separate thoughts. One reaction to what you've heard in the previous lectures, one reflection upon it, and one regret. Let me take those in reverse order, and I'll start with the regret. I regret that I omitted what the Israelis call the War of the Generals from the previous lectures. So let me do something now to correct that omission so that it doesn't become a mechdal. The War of the Generals refers to the feuds that broke out among IDF commanders regarding the mistakes of the Yom Kippur War. The fighting among them began during the war itself, and it continued for many years afterwards. In fact, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that some of those debates are still ongoing. The War of the Generals matters, among other reasons, just for that reason, because it is the starting pistol for the historical debate over the war. In the 1960s, Philip Graham, the legendary publisher of the Washington Post, famously said that journalism is the rough draft of history. In Israel, feuding IDF commanders are the ones who write the rough draft. The journalists simply take dictation from the generals. Consider the case of Uri Dan. He's a famous Israeli journalist who died in 2006. Some of you probably know him as Ariel Sharon's biographer. He was the author of Ariel Sharon, An Intimate Portrait. During the Yom Kippur War, Dan served as Ariel Sharon's unofficial press agent, sitting at Sharon's side in his command car as he crossed the Suez Canal, documenting the general's major moves and recording all the thoughts that the general wanted recorded, in public at least. During the Lebanon War in the early 1980s, when Sharon was defense minister, Dan dropped the pretense of being an objective reporter and simply became Sharon's official spokesman. Not all IDF commanders had their own personal representative in the press, but when they had something to say, interested reporters were easy enough to find. With respect to those commanders who weren't all that interested in having their words recorded, the press had multiple contacts who were more than willing to get the inside information that they needed. Division headquarters were swirling with reserve officers whose personal connections reached into all aspects of Israeli professional life. Friends talked to friends, and the news of the feuds spread widely. The generals were politicized to a degree that is mind-boggling. Ariel Sharon, who was central to the War of the Generals, was also a political candidate in the national elections, which would have taken place on October 30th, 1973, if the Yom Kippur War hadn't broken out 3 weeks earlier. Sharon retired from the military in August 1973, and he entered the reserves. The following month, he played a major role in creating the Likud Party, which is an amalgamation of 5 right-wing parties under the leadership of Menachem Begin. On October 5th, 1973, when Sharon received the call to report for reserve duty in order to go to war, he was literally sitting in Likud campaign headquarters which he was in charge of. As a talented tank commander, a celebrated hero of the Six-Day War, and an officer in the reserves, he was immediately handed the command of a tank division. During the war, soldiers called that division the Likud Division. As a result of this politicization, it's extremely difficult to disentangle the debates about strategy inside the IDF from the national political debate. In the week before the high command gave Sharon the go-ahead to cross the canal into Egypt, he had been chomping at the bit, begging them to let him do so. He came very close to defying orders. When he finally got the green light, he was convinced that his superiors had given him a role designed to minimize his contribution in order to weaken him politically. Many of you, I am sure, are familiar with the photo of Sharon in the desert with his head bandaged. That photo became an iconic image of the conflict. His detractors claimed that the photo was staged, a political stunt. They admitted that the wound was real enough. He'd bumped his head on a machine gun that was mounted on a tank. But the critics claimed that it had been showcased to make Sharon look especially heroic for the elections. During the war, the Knesset voted to postpone the election to the end of December. Sharon was released from reserve duty in January and took up his position as a member of the Knesset for the Likud party. Golda Meir's Labor Party won the election, but was deeply wounded because of the performance during the war. When Sharon was released from military service, he gave a farewell statement to his unit. He announced himself as the greatest military hero in the history of the IDF, and he lambasted the IDF leadership and the government. Let me read you a quote. "It was our division that initiated and took upon itself the most difficult, complex, and brutal operation of the war, the crossing of the canal. It was the success of the canal crossing that changed things and turned the war around. It was the success of the canal crossing that brought victory in the war. We must remember that our victory in the Yom Kippur War is the greatest of the victories we have ever had. Despite the mistakes and mechdals," there's that word again, "despite the mistakes and mechdals, despite the setbacks and the roadblocks that were put in our way, despite the loss of nerve and the loss of control, we managed to achieve victory. It is good for all of us to know that this was the greatest victory the IDF has ever won." The individual whose reputation was most damaged by Sharon's attacks was General Shmuel Gonen, also known as Gorodish. Before leaving the army to pursue a political career, Sharon had served for some 3 years as head of Israel's Southern Command, which was responsible for the Egyptian front. When he retired, it was Gorodish who replaced him. So when the war began and the reserves were called up, Sharon and his division had to answer to Gorodish, who had only been in the job for 3 months. Sharon and Gorodish quickly fell out, and bitterly so. Some of the most fierce battles in the War of the Generals were between these two men. Gorodish lost the war with Sharon, most of whose attacks on Gorodish were probably justified, although I can't really claim to have delved deeply into this subject. The truth is that at various points during the war, the high command was furious with either Gorodish or Sharon, or with both of them. The interim report of the Agronaut Commission, that's the commission that investigated the reasons for the failures at the outset of the war, the report determined that Gorodish, quote, "did not adequately fulfill his duties, and that he bears a significant part of the responsibility for the dangerous situation in which our forces were caught," unquote. Gorodish was suspended from service. For years, he tried to clear his name, but without success. In 1987, Gorodish was living in the jungles of the Central African Republic, where he was running a diamond mine. When an Israeli reporter tracked him down for a series of interviews, he espoused a conspiracy theory about the Yom Kippur War. This is the same theory that we are all now very familiar with. According to this theory, Defense Minister Moshe Dayan and American National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger concocted a plan to deliver a limited military victory to Egypt in the war. Gorodish's anger at Dayan was so great that for a time he contemplated murdering the former defense minister. "I planned to enter his office and kill him from close range," Gorodish told the reporter. He died of a heart attack in Italy in 1991 at the age of 60. While Gorodish has few defenders, and while he does seem to have been the wrong man for the job of running the Southern Command in the war, it is hard to escape the conclusion from the vantage point of 50 years later that the defense establishment in general, and Moshe Dayan in particular, used Gorodish as a scapegoat. At the end of the war, Dayan began hitching his political wagon to Sharon's rising star. Another iconic photo of the war, taken by Uri Don, shows a smiling, uniformed Dayan standing next to Sharon with a bandage on Sharon's head. This was after many tense exchanges between the two men during the previous weeks. Remember, Dayan was a minister of defense, whose near psychological collapse during the war had lost him the respect of the prime minister and of the top leadership of the IDF. What was a senior minister in the government doing on the battlefield with a general with whom he had been warring just weeks before, in the middle of the war? The answer is obvious. He was getting his photo taken and rehabilitating his reputation. Gorodish's rage toward Dayan was hardly unique. Shortly after the end of the fighting, Yaakov Shimshon Shapira, the Minister of Justice in Golda Meir's cabinet, publicly demanded that Dayan resign. But Meir chastised Shapira, and she forced him to resign instead of Dayan. Many in the public and in the press strongly criticized Meir for her handling of this episode. Despite having disciplined Shapira, Meir came to believe that honor and decency indeed required Dayan to resign. Her breaking point with him came when the Agranat Commission recommended the resignation of the Chief of Staff, General David Elazar. Meir respected Elazar. After the initial losses, Elazar had shown remarkable resilience in recovering lost ground and in managing an exceptionally fast-moving and chaotic war. It's likely that he is one of the great unsung heroes of the IDF's history. As defense minister, Dayan had only increased the level of chaos by meddling in operational decision-making. But the Agranat Commission scrupulously avoided assigning responsibility to civilian officials, a technicality that Dayan treated as a personal vindication. Golda Meir did not share his view. Why was Elazar responsible, but Dayan, who was deeply involved in operations, not? The decision struck many, especially Meir, as deeply unjust. The War of the Generals, as it played out in the press, was not just the rough draft of history. It was also the mechanism by which the problems of the Labor Party establishment, which had been running the country for decades, revealed themselves to the public. Although Menachem Begin's Likud would not come to power until 1977, its rise owed much to the controversies that the Yom Kippur War had unleashed. In another world, Moshe Dayan, a canny political survivor, might have been held to account alongside General Gorodish for the mechdals of the war. But instead of escaping to the jungles of Africa, he escaped with Sharon into the right wing of the Israeli political system. In 1977, he abandoned the Labor Party, ran as an independent, and then joined Begin's government as foreign minister. Now, if you'll allow me, I'll move from my regret, that's my regret at not having discussed the War of the Generals before, to my reflection. If I'm asked what was my biggest discovery about the Yom Kippur War, I'm reminded of a story told to me by a friend who took a course in college on the French Revolution. The professor teaching the course was brilliant, but very disorganized. The class got stuck in the 1660s, the period that probably most interested the professor. He never took the students out of the 17th century, let alone all the way to 1789. In that same spirit, if you ask me what's the most important thing that I have learned recently about the Yom Kippur War of 1973, I'll tell you that it was the importance of the War of Attrition in 1969 and 1970. Perhaps you've felt the gravitational pull of the War of Attrition, the gravitational pull that it was exerting on me during these previous episodes. In the past, when I taught the history of the Arab-Israeli conflict, I would always jump quickly from the Six-Day War directly to the Yom Kippur War. As I moved from the gains of 67 to the pains of 73, I would just wave at the War of Attrition as I sped by. I interpreted this conflict simply as the death throes of Nasserism. Nasser was a dying man, both literally and figuratively. and the war was the last expression of his failed project to unite the Arabs by destroying the Jews. I'm hardly alone in ignoring the war of attrition. Both the Israelis and the Egyptians have all but forgotten the conflict. It ended in a stalemate, and the war brought about no changes to the status quo that were big enough to make a lasting impression on the respective collective memories of the Egyptians and the Israelis. Intellectually, however, we ignore the war of attrition at our peril. I now realize that it was a very consequential historical event, an event that is absolutely crucial for understanding the Yom Kippur War. Every major decision maker in 1973, whether they're Israelis, Egyptians, or Soviets, or Americans for that matter, every one of them occupied a position of great responsibility during the War of Attrition. It was this conflict that generated the strategic assumptions that shaped the Yom Kippur War. As I argued in these lectures, my working assumption is that Sadat's strategy in 1973 actually came together in 1970. I also believe that the Nixon-Kissinger strategy came together in July of that year, when Henry Kissinger briefed reporters at San Clemente saying that the goal of American foreign policy was to expel the Soviet forces from Egypt. Nixon and Kissinger never wavered from that strategy, as I have argued, and it was a great success. It brought Egypt out of the Soviet camp into the American camp, and it resulted in the first Arab-Israeli peace agreement, a peace agreement that is held to this day. But we also can't understand some of the key attitudes and decisions of Golda Meir and Moshe Dayan if we don't start the story in 1970 instead of in 1973. Most importantly, we can't understand their decision not to launch a preemptive strike against the Egyptians and Syrians if we don't start the story in 1970. At that point, Israel was facing off not just against Egypt, but against the Soviet Union. The threat of a direct conflict with a superpower heightened the Israelis' sense of existential threat, and it gave them a profound sense of dependence on the United States. I presented to you the Israeli acceptance of Secretary of State William Rogers' ceasefire proposal in August 1970 as a quid pro quo. Israel received from the Nixon administration a guarantee of its qualitative military edge, or QME, and also an assurance that the United States would not force it to return to the June 5, 1967 lines. In return, Israel agreed to end hostilities, or that is to have a ceasefire, in a way that could be seen, a way that they feared it could be seen, in the eyes of the Soviets and the Egyptians as a capitulation, especially because Moscow and Cairo had used the ceasefire, you will remember, to move their SAM wall eastward right up to the banks of the Suez Canal. There can be no doubt that the Israelis saw this as a quid pro quo. At a meeting between President Nixon and Ambassador Yitzhak Rabin on August 17, 1970, Rabin said that Golda Meir wanted Nixon to know that Israel had only accepted the ceasefire because of Nixon's personal letter to Meir guaranteeing the QME. In that letter, Nixon promised not to force Israel to withdraw from territory or to accept a large number of Palestinian refugees, a number so large that it would endanger Israeli security. Rabin made it clear that Israel had expressed a willingness to negotiate under the auspices of Secretary of State Rogers only because of that letter. As you'll remember, in the previous episodes, Roger was a typical proponent of the honest broker approach and no friend of Israel. Rabin told Nixon that he had grave doubts as to the wisdom of this course of action due both to the military and the political risks involved in accepting the ceasefire. Nixon's response was crucial for understanding the decision that Golda Meir would make 3 years later on October 6, 1973, even as the Egyptians and the Syrian armies were barreling down on Israel. It was important, Nixon said, that no one hold Israel responsible for a breakdown of the ceasefire. If the Rogers Peace Initiative were to fail, everyone should recognize who was at fault, Nixon said. He hoped that it would be the Egyptians who would be blamed and not the Israelis. These were the most difficult times for Israel, Nixon said, and it would be necessary for it to demonstrate a maximum degree of self-restraint. That's a direct quote. I owe this insight about American guarantees of QME and Golda Meir's restraint to my good friend David Wormser. As far as I know, no historian or no other analyst has ever pointed out the connection between the guarantees of QME and Israel's decision not to preempt in the Yom Kippur War. From this conversation and many other exchanges like it, including the exchanges between Israeli officials and Henry Kissinger on October 6, 1973, Golda Meir concluded that the quid pro quo with the United States included a commitment by Israel not to launch a preemptive strike. The commitment came at a very high cost to Israel, perhaps a cost that was too high. But for anyone who wants to evaluate whether the price was indeed too high, one must also consider what Meir, in essence, told the Agranat Commission in her testimony, namely, that with Nixon's demand for restraint also came the promise of the resupply. And with that, let me bring this lecture series to a conclusion with one final reaction to all of the material that we have covered. I have implied in these lectures, but I haven't stated clearly, that the conventional evaluations of what constitutes a pro-Israel policymaker are misguided. The pro-Israel community is too often swayed by the type of politicians who don kippahs to exclaim before synagogues that they really love Jews and Israel, and that they really get Israel in their kishkas. The kishkas test, I submit, is the wrong test to put American leaders to. There are three key tests to evaluate the pro-Israel bona fides of an American leader, and none of them have anything to do with love of Israel or love of the Jews. Each of these tests can be summed up by a very easy question. One, do they have a coherent strategy toward the Middle East? That's toward the Middle East as a whole, not toward Israel. Two, do they regard Israel as an asset in that strategy? And three, have they clearly defined the respective roles and missions of Israel and the United States in pursuing that strategy? These tests, taken together, are the most that can be expected by the pro-Israel community of an American leader. Very few American presidents have passed all three tests. Nixon and Kissinger passed them, I would submit, and not just passed them, they passed them when the stakes for the United States were extremely high, when America's vital interests were truly on the line because of the intensive involvement of the Soviet Union. Their example teaches us, however, that even when the tests are passed with flying colors, tensions in the relationship will remain. Conflicts and disagreements will erupt because American and Israeli interests cannot be, and therefore never will be, identical. The disparity in size and power between the United States and Israel means that Israel will disproportionately bear the cost of mechdals, including the mechdals of America herself. The Yom Kippur War teaches us a profound truth, that a mistake by a small power is a national tragedy, whereas a mistake by a great power is a footnote in the history books. Given this disparity, the war also teaches us something else, that Israel must forever be wary of becoming a vassal, of simply doing whatever America demands of it because America is ultimately a guarantor of its qualitative military edge. I have made no secret in these lectures of my profound respect both for the insights of Henry Kissinger and for his performance under circumstances of extreme strain. I have repeatedly quoted him at length thanks to his gift for clearly capturing the challenges that the Middle Eastern strategic landscape poses. It is only fitting and proper, therefore, to close this series with a long quote from Kissinger explaining how Israel's refusal to be a vassal actually works, when all is said and done, to advance the American interest. Quote, "Israel is dependent on the U.S. as no other country is on a friendly power. Increasingly, Washington is the sole capital to stand by Israel in international forums. We are its exclusive military supplier, its only military ally, though no formal obligation exists. It takes a special brand of heroism to turn total dependence into defiance, to insist on support as a matter of right rather than as a favor, to turn every American deviation from an Israeli cabinet consensus into a betrayal to be punished rather than a disagreement to be negotiated. And yet, Israel's obstinacy, maddening as it can be, serves the purposes of both our countries best. A subservient client would soon face an accumulation of ever-growing pressures. It would tempt Israel's neighbors to escalate their demands. It would saddle us with opprobrium for every deadlock. Our relationship with Israel is exhilarating and frustrating. It is ennobled by the devotion and faith that contain a lesson for an age of cynicism, exasperating because the interests of a superpower and of a regional mini-state are not always easy to reconcile, and are on occasion unbridgeable. Israel affects our decisions through inspiration, persistence, and a judicious, not always subtle or discreet influence on our domestic policy, unquote. Israelis are the biggest asset to America when they remain true to themselves as a stiff-necked people.